Welcome to this edition of the Radio Facts Radio Show. My name is Kevin Ross, and on this show, radio on the digital cliff. We're talking about commercial radio, a new white paper on the changing audio entertainment paradigm and radio's response. This new report examines changing markets for audio entertainment and threats to traditional broadcast radio. We'll be right back to talk to the head of the Steinhardt Music Business Program at New York University, Professor Larry Miller, on his controversial report concerning commercial radio. So to all my friends in the radio and broadcasting industry who may be doing things related to broadcasting or production online, of course, you want to make sure that you produce quality materials, whether it be for a podcast, a website, blog, marketing materials, images, or any additional production that you may be working on. So I want to recommend a company that can help you out. VideoBlocks can not only help you save money, but they can also give you the quality that you need for your materials at a fraction of the cost. We all know that having great quality is always going to get you the greatest response. If you've ever been in the market for a quick soundbite, video or image, then VideoBlocks is for you. You can get the studio quality stocks, download all the studio video you need from their member library, including HD footage, After Effects templates, motion backgrounds, and a lot more. Plus, save on millions of additional marketplace clips where artists take home 100% of the sales price. All content is royalty free, so you can use it for commercial and personal projects. New clips are added regularly, so there's always something for you to download. Go to videoblocks.com/Kevin Ross to get all the stock footage you can imagine for just $149 a year. VideoBlocks.com/Kevin Ross to save on millions of studio quality clips from VideoBlocks.
This is the Radio Facts Radio Show, brought to you by RadioFacts.com.
So I see you've written a very interesting white paper. And, of course, it's on the potential demise of commercial radio. Now, I know I've seen several people respond to it. I was just wondering, what kind of responses have you been getting to it?
Well, predictably, the NAB reacted quickly and defensively with, I think, for the most part, arguments that are tired old arguments that we've heard before. However, as they continue to level those same arguments, radio audiences continue to get a little smaller and listen a little shorter each year. And over the long period of time that we observed teen listening in particular in this study, certainly the trend among today's teens who are tomorrow's 18 to 34s and beyond, that trend is not radio's friend. And so that's part of the response that we've received so far. However, if you look out at the interwebs and on social media, the opposite reaction is true, and certainly on anything that either I or Musonomics or NYU are associated with, we're seeing everyone from music industry friends as well as people who I've never met in my life, and radio executives, including some who are quoted in the study. Including people who have spent their entire careers of many decades in the radio business supporting our findings. So there you have it. The NAB, I suppose, are entitled to their own set of facts, and they're sticking to them. However, I stand by this paper.
What do you think the denial, if there is denial, is coming from? Do you think that's because these are people who have to work in radio, or do you think that they actually believe radio's not in trouble?
Well, I grew up in the radio industry, and although you might not be able to tell from reading the paper, I still love radio, and I consider myself a past and present radio historian, and I care deeply about the health of the medium. However, even back when I was going to the NAB conventions, the big NAB with television in Las Vegas, as well as the NAB radio shows, there was kind of a, I don't know, willful ignorance of embracing some of the facts that I think have been on, you know, on the ground now for quite a long period of time. For example, 20 years ago, for anybody that's been around radio for a long time, when streaming on-air signals and even just webcasting started becoming a thing in the late 90s, sort of leading up to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in 1998, and those years, those intervening years between 1998 and 2003, when we were kind of post-Napster and pre-Pandora and certainly pre-iTunes, you know, you had a real sense that the future was, if not at hand, at least it was visible out on the horizon. And radio has always talked about the power and strength and resilience of its strong local brands. And I sat there at those NABs year after year after year, and I just thought, you know, don't they see this coming? Mm-hmm. I mean, at some point, the automotive dashboard, I would think to myself, sitting in those big rooms in Las Vegas in, you know, 1995, 6, 7, 8, you know, I would say to myself, you know, things are going to change. The automotive dashboard someday is going to reconfigure. Someday soon, and of course, sitting here in 2017, it's almost laughable to think about this, but someday soon, I thought, every audio signal and data service that there is going to be on a level playing field. And in the car, I mean, in particular, and of course, the report goes into smart speakers, and we talk about other things too. But when every digital audio signal and data service that there is on a level playing field, we're going to find out how strong and powerful and resilient those local radio brands really, you know, truly are. And I think that we're starting to discover that now.
Do you think that radio may have shot itself in the foot with cookie cutter formats, jocks on leashes, hardcore branding, and consultants? You think that's part of the problem?
Well, that is a really complicated question, but I'll try to unpack it as best I can. So I don't think we can lay this at the feet of consultants in particular. You know, they are hired to do a job, right? And the last time I checked, the job is to shore up ratings and provide a competitive advantage for stations and companies in markets that are in dogfights with the competition. That's the job. And then it is the job of the local radio operator to turn what may be a relatively ephemeral ratings advantage into cash flow. But there are other forces at work that I think help drive the industry to the position that it is in. And for that, I think we need to go back to 1996 and the Telecom Act, which, although there had been a fair amount of radio consolidation in the, 15 years or so before that. I mean, I remember when I first got into the business, ownership limits were set at 777s or 7 TVs with no newspaper cross ownership, God forbid. And then I remember 12-12-12, and then duopolies were allowed, and then came the Telecom Act, and look, you don't need me to go chapter and verse on, you know, what has happened to creativity, listenership, job creation, or employee satisfaction in the radio industry in now the 20 plus, you know, intervening years from the Telecom Act to today. I think that the cost as a society has been enormous, and that on the one hand, on the other hand, tremendous wealth was generated for relatively few operators and shareholders. But that is the society that we live in.
This is the Radio Facts Radio Show, brought to you by RadioFacts.com, your online information station.
So when you look at the podcasting landscape, for example, there are some superior podcasts out there from people with very little experience. And I also look at social media, where you have kids with huge social media numbers. Why would they want to go work for a radio station? Where is the new group of jocks going to come from in order to keep commercial radio afloat? These kids already have leverage. So there's no such thing as paying dues. There's no such thing as accepting pay that is comparable to what they're being offered directly from corporations. Just to read script or tweet something out. So they have basically created their own platforms. And my question is, what is the lure? What would attract them to radio and to want to work for someone else?
Well, I want to reframe the question a little bit. I don't know really whether there is a shortage of jocks the way that you asked the question, but I will say that there is a dearth of talent that is attracted to going on the radio in fairly dramatic contrast to what it was like a generation ago. And you know, in writing this paper, I had to stop myself at the end when I was doing a wrap up of the paper. I had to stop myself from kind of coming with a prescription for what it is that radio ought to do. I mean, really, I don't think the radio industry needs me in particular to write them a prescription for the things that they ought to do. And really, I don't think that my recommendations would have landed any better, I suppose, than the rest of my report, at least not for the NAB, you know. But if you look at the most popular podcasts, the vast majority of them are being produced and hosted by people who have something to say. They are people who are brilliant and captivating storytellers. And that particular skill would appear to be not only in short supply on the air, but it is almost at cross purposes with what commercial radio has become. I can't really speak to the specifics of urban radio, but does what I'm talking about here resonate for you? What do you think?
Well, it was actually rhetorical. I knew the answer, but I just wanted to get your view. To your point, I'm actually inclined to agree that I've heard some amazing podcasts out there. And I mean, people who have very little experience with radio, they got the editing down pat. They got the breaks. They got the commercials. They got all of what radio needs to be compelling. And that leverage is opening many more doors for people with a lot less experience.
They're coming in with, absolutely, they're coming in with their own audiences. And if they are growing beyond their podcast, they are going and creating their own YouTube channels. Some of them are getting television deals. A number of them are getting book deals. And, you know, where are the ones who are going to radio?
You know, the current situation is a conundrum because I'm a radio pro and an entrepreneur. So I get where the jocks and the programmers are coming from, but I also understand the corporation's need to protect its brand. Unfortunately, today, everything is about branding. It's not just the corporation. The corporation is the umbrella that has to incorporate the jocks. I mean, it's an excellent opportunity to promote your brand. And I think that radio is changing on that. I think that they understand that they have to use their jocks to promote what they're doing. I'm just wondering if it might be a little too late. Few people are saying it out loud, but in industry conversations I've been having, there are those who hope that iHeart does go bankrupt at the end of the year because the opportunity for commercial radio to compete will happen again. What are your thoughts on that?
Maybe so, and maybe the company is just too big, and maybe by selling off stations, that would allow for a new type and a new generation of station owners to enter the business and be bold. Depending on how they are allowed to buy those stations, be able to afford to be bold, because, you know, part of I think what has driven the kind of corporate radio behavior that I think we're kind of talking around in this conversation is that not only has radio consolidated, and, you know, you could argue whether that is a good thing for shareholders and a bad thing for, you know, radio people and listeners at the same time, you know, but in order to service the debt involved in doing a massive roll-up, you know, like iHeart, or, you know, or I guess the deal of the year is, you know, Entercom CBS, you know, requires taking on billions of dollars in debt, and that debt is costly, and that cost ends up severely constraining operations and, you know, at the end of the day, putting a lid on risk-taking and creativity, which is something that radio used to just be brilliant at.
So worst-case scenario, say that there is a problem. Radio just can't go off the air.
No. Well, you know, I mean, I suppose you could argue that, you know, maybe really, really, really struggling stations ought to have a deal struck with the federal government in which the FCC is allowed to take that spectrum space back for, you know, for a fee, and allow that spectrum space to be repurposed for other kinds of new advanced services, exactly the kinds of services that radio seems unwilling or unable to do, you know, at this point. You know, barring that kind of a spectrum reallocation or a spectrum trade, I think that, you know, what we can see is honestly, you know, more of the same. I think that, you know, broadcast companies will continue to operate much in the way that they have, you know, until they are forced to, you know, do something different. And, you know, one thing that would be different for the American radio industry to do would be to pay record companies and the people who perform on sound recordings for the music that they make. And, you know, it has become almost a hackneyed argument at this point. But the United States is the only civilized country on the face of the earth with advanced intellectual property laws,
right,
that pays record companies and artists zero.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that many people in radio who aren't either in the management or policy side kind of miss this point. And they may say, yeah, but, you know, we pay ASCAP and BMI and you know, CSAC, you know, doesn't that cover it? And the answer is no, that doesn't cover it. That pays for the right in the underlying musical compositions, the songs themselves, and ASCAP and BMI collect money for music publishers and songwriters and distribute out that money. But on the record company side, we are literally the only country on the planet with advanced IP laws that doesn't do this. You know, the other companies that are on this page are, you know, Rwanda, Iraq, you know, China. It's laughable at this point. And yet the NAB continues to use the same old arguments that they have for many decades. And, you know, I hope that over this next, 5 to 10 years, that we'll see a new alignment of interest, because the simple fact of the matter is that 3/4 of what is on radio is music, and music drives about 3/4 of the revenue collected by the entire radio business. And, you know, and there is a, you know, symbiotic relationship there. I think it's time for a recalculation of value on both sides.
We'll be back with more of Radio Facts Radio Show after this.
When it comes to jocks, I think they're scared. And I think that you have a whole slew of jocks that were trained in a system where they were adherent, and that system has drastically changed. And at this point, they're not only scared, but a bit confused, but aware that they need to be proactive in order to keep working. And that means they're going to have to go against the grain.
I think you said that very well. And, you know, for me, I started doing the Musonomics podcast a little bit over 2 years ago, over not so much frustration. I wasn't really frustrated about anything, but it kind of dawned on me that, you know, podcasting was really starting to become a big deal, that the tools of production and distribution have become democratized in the same way that the tools of music making have become democratized. And, you know, you can, you know, if you have the skill, you can make something that sounds like a pretty good record in your bedroom studio. And just as much, you can make a commercially competitive sounding podcast in your home project studio. And I thought, well, you know, why not? And so, you know, today we have a big audience for the Musonomics podcast without having a broadcast partner driving the traffic in our direction. And it's been all organic. And I think it's because of the way we produce the show and the way that we tell stories.
When did you become a professor?
Well, I became a professor really 6 years ago. I am not a career academic. I became one relatively recently, and it was a slippery slope for me. I started as an entrepreneur in residence, and co-taught an entrepreneurship class at NYU. And then I became an adjunct faculty member, which is to say you're teaching one course and, you know, you get no benefit. But that was okay because I was still doing other things and running some, you know, digital music companies. And then when there was an opportunity to join the full-time faculty, I jumped at the opportunity, because having tried it on for a year or two as an adjunct, I knew that that my future was really about standing in front of a classroom training the next generation of people who were going to invent the future of the music industry and build new kinds of services that will be the, you know, the new ways that people interact with music. And for me, what could be more exciting than that?
So as far as your undergraduate students, what's the general consensus when it comes to how they feel about the music industry?
Well, they're excited about it. I mean, they're investing a gigantic amount of money and their entire college career, and have convinced their parents, maybe even more important, that's what they ought to do, to get trained in our program anyway, actual music, actual business, and sort of the overlap between music and business, and that is actually understanding the business structure of the music industry and concert management and A&R and marketing and promotion, the international digital services, entrepreneurship, as well as the other analytic skills that we give them as part of being in a program like ours that includes, you know, macro and microeconomics and, you know, and other tools that we hope will enable them to analyze opportunities as they come into view, and, you know, and take their passion for music and go build the future, because, you know, I'm not going to do it, but they are. They are required, the undergrads anyway, are required to do at least 3 internships before they graduate. And, you know, being in New York and at NYU, I mean, all of the major record companies and music publishers, all of the digital services companies, all of the performing rights organizations, the live music platforms, Live Nation and AEG, the major booking agencies, the management companies, I mean, all of the music ecosystem are recruiting our students into internships. Many of them are offered jobs upon graduation. But, you know, honestly, some of them go through 4 years of training like this, including the internships, and come to the conclusion that, you know, what they want to do is go to grad school, or, you know, I run school recommendations every year. Some of them, you know, some of them are going to go to law school. Some of them are going into, you know, other industries. Many of them are going to work for technology companies. Some of them are going to go out and start their own startup or go work in somebody else's startup. But, you know, they are well trained in, you know, how to be agile and deliver value in a highly, highly volatile marketplace. And I think that they're comfortable with that ambiguity and volatility.
The edition of the Radio Facts Radio Show was brought to you by RadioFacts.com, your online information station. Contact Kevin at RadioFacts.com.